Live from the Ken and Valerie Baker Studio at WHYY, this is Studio 2.
On Tuesday, June 2nd, welcome, friends, on into the program. I'm Cherry Gregg.
I'm Avi Wolfman Arendt.
So what happens after someone is detained by ICE? It's a big question. A lot of folks don't know. Protests outside of Delaney Hall in Newark, New Jersey, have drawn national attention to conditions inside immigration detention facilities. Demonstrators and their attorneys, they all allege that detainees are dealing with spoiled food, inadequate medical care, and unsanitary conditions. Federal officials dispute many of the claims. And just today, the New Jersey Attorney General filed a lawsuit against the GEO Group, which operates the Delaney Hall facility. They've requested that the court give them access to the facility and so that they can do their own inspections. And so we have a lot of questions about what is happening in these detention centers in New Jersey and Pennsylvania and all across the country. What type of due process is owed to individuals who are detained by ICE? How long can someone be kept in these facilities? So many questions. And we have an immigration attorney. We have a national reporter on the show. And we're going to peel back the layers. We have a lot of questions, a lot of concerns, as I'm sure you do as well. And so our question of the day is, what are your questions? What are your opinions about immigration detention in America right now? There have been a lot of change in leadership and the Department of Homeland Security. And so we want to know what you think about that and what questions you have. The number to call is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on Facebook or YouTube, you can put your questions or opinions in the live stream and in the live chat. And by the way, Avi, as we were sitting here getting ready for the show, the breaking news happened that lawsuit was filed. So this is front and center in the headlines right now.
Yeah, a developing story. So we're keeping it open-ended today. What are your questions or opinions about immigration detention in America? 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. But first, a trio of local news stories, and we'll actually start in New Jersey today.
Oh, yeah.
It is primary day in NJ. Garden State residents are headed to the polls. There are a few competitive races in our region. Just going to run down a few of them right now. New Jersey's 12th Congressional District, which includes parts of northern and central Jersey, including Trenton. There's a competitive race there. Incumbent Democrat Bonnie Watson Coleman is leaving office. There are 13 Democrats vying to replace her in this heavily Democratic district, one Republican on the ballot as well. It's considered a safe seat for whichever Dem wins today. Then you've got NJ2, which covers much of the Jersey Shore and a swath of sort of far south Jersey. The incumbent there is Jeff Van Drew, a former Democrat, now Republican. There are four Democrats lining up to replace him. Mm-hmm. And maybe the district getting the most attention right now, it's a little outside of our region, but NJ7, it's mostly in North Jersey. It goes a little into what you might call Central Jersey. Republican incumbent Tom Kane Jr. has not been seen publicly since March. He's dealing with an undisclosed medical issue. He's missed more than 100 floor votes, according to the New York Times. There are four Democrats lining up to challenge him. That could be a pretty purple district, depending on how things are trending in November. So a lot of interest in that race.
Yeah, and there's also some Republicans running to challenge Democratic U.S. Senator Cory Booker, who was on the show not too long ago. Yep. So interesting day in New Jersey. By the way, New Jersey is just one of six primaries that's happening today across the country, including in California and in Iowa. A key Senate race is happening, by the way, in Iowa, where Democrats hope to flip that seat. The governor's primary race in California, everybody's paying attention to that, as well as the mayor's race in Los Angeles. So, you know, tonight is going to be an interesting news night as people, you know, start to look at the who's winning and who's losing and those primaries, including in New Jersey.
Yeah, and those tea leaves on where the various parties are trending.
Yeah.
You always get that at the end of a primary night.
Like, so what does this mean for Democrats?
What does this mean? Yes, existential questions.
Yeah. So
some big questions on story number two, a story that actually connects New Jersey and Philadelphia. Go ahead, Cherry.
Yeah, the vendor that supplied the concrete and that deadly garage collapse in Gray's Ferry back in April has had another garage site shut down and deemed unsafe for human occupancy. Mm. Very interesting story by the Philadelphia Inquirer. Apparently, 2 weeks after that multi-level garage collapse on April 8th, it killed three people in Gray's Ferry. A township inspector shut down a new 700-car parking garage for the Community Medical Center in Toms River, New Jersey. That garage had been open for only about 14 months. It was being used by patients and hospital staff during that time. But inspectors discovered that two of the concrete roof panels in that garage were found to be sagging under their own weight. And so they shut it down. The Inquirer reports that the concrete panel used in both the collapsed garage in Gray's Ferry, which was being built for Children's Hospital Philadelphia, by the way, as well as that garage in Toms River, they were both supplied by Brayman Precast, which is a subcontractor to High Concrete. Now, there are all sorts of questions being raised about whether there were defects in those concrete panels. There's also questions about whether the panels had been used in other projects as well. So the Inquirer interviewed an engineering expert who said that the concrete panels used in constructing the garage, they're extremely dense,
yep,
but they are weak under pressure. And I should mention that the feds have not yet determined what caused that collapse in Gray's Ferry. But this definitely raises concerns. The lawyers who represent the families of those people who died in that collapse, they're looking at this as well, wondering who's to blame.
Yeah, and that's why investigations like this are so critical. Because if you can determine what the cause of this collapse in Gray's Ferry, it could point to other problems in other already standing structures. That's the specter looming over all of this now. Is this some sort of systematic issue that could be an issue in other structures that are being used? Remember, this other garage in New Jersey was being used before it was shut down. And so that's why it's so important to get to the bottom of this. As you mentioned, we truly do not know yet. We're not jumping to any conclusions. But it's good reporting by the Inquirer to draw this link to say maybe this is something worth looking at.
Yeah, for sure. And you want to make sure no one gets hurt. So they shut it down just to make sure. It could reopen. That's according to the folks in Toms River. But we don't know. For now, it's shut down.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Story number three. It is a new era.
Oh.
For one of the city's saddest and tragically underused passageways. I'm talking about the 1,500-foot underground walkway that connects City Hall Station with Walnut Locust along the Broad Street line. It reopened today. It had been closed since the pandemic for 6 years.
That's a long time.
It's a long time. SEPTA officials said they did not have the manpower to keep it clean and safe, but now they have reopened it as we expect this big influx of visitors for the World Cup and the 250, etc. I'm going to be honest.
Uh-huh.
This space has always been a little creepy.
Definitely.
Always smelled a little bit like urine.
Pew, pew.
So this is our chance to reclaim it, make it something special. And I have to say, generally, in Philly, we have a lot of these underground concourses and walkways that could serve a great purpose, but they're often kind of icky. So let's take this moment here, Cherry, to try to reclaim this one. Take a moment. Make it something beautiful.
Yeah.
Do you have any suggestions for how we can make this particular concourse a little less icky?
Yeah, you got to clean it on the regular.
Yes.
Maybe multiple times a day. Maybe put in some strategically placed vendors selling beverages and snacks so it's populated. And bathrooms, because I think people tend to cock and take a pee because they got to go and there's no place to pee.
Okay,
I'm going to let that one land. On the radio, but
I'm gonna let that one land.
There's a real issue here.
Yes.
So
yes.
Bathrooms.
Producer Debbie says street musicians. She thinks if we had some street musicians down there would liven it up. I kind of agree with that.
I kind of like that. That's good.
EP Kevin says we should look to cold weather countries for inspiration. He says in Helsinki, Finland, they have a whole underground city with like a sports complex and a pool. That sounds pretty cool.
A Philly SEPTA pool.
Yeah,
okay.
Maybe it wouldn't work here.
Okay.
But we're casting a wide net.
But EP Kevin's trying.
He's trying. Producer Hazel says paint the walls bright colors, murals. I like that.
Murals, we're a mural city. That's good.
That fits with the Philly brand.
With the vibe. Although it might get, a little graffiti.
Well, whatever. That's fine. I think you have to start by addressing the smell.
Facts.
And when you want a good smell in a space...
Potpourri?
No.
I'm sorry.
Sure, maybe. I was going to say, why don't we just get like 6 Cinnabons down there?
Ooh, that's good.
Because no one really wants to eat Cinnabon, but the smell is amazing.
It's delicious.
Yeah, so maybe we could just but you said street vendors as well. I think that would work as well.
Something cooking, yeah.
Something cookies, that smells bacon, good, a food smell, pretzels. Make it inviting. And then once you get people down there, then you could do all sorts of stuff. You could, you know, have the musicians, you could have the shops, all that kind of
stuff.
And
some bathrooms.
Some bathrooms would be nice.
Yeah.
So.
There you go.
That's our recommendation for the concourse. It's a whole city down there. People don't know. There's a whole city under Philly that's really not all that used.
Yeah, and we should use it.
It's a great resource. Coming up on the show today, we're talking about ICE detention in America. We're going to get the latest from 2 experts. Don't go anywhere. You're listening to Studio 2. And welcome back to Studio 2 on WHYY. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. Protests outside the Delaney Hall Detention Center in Newark have continued even after Governor Mikey Sherrill appealed for calm and imposed a nightly curfew. A hunger strike by detainees over alleged poor living conditions sparked demonstrations outside, which at times have turned violent and have led to multiple arrests.
NJ.com spoke yesterday with 2 recently released detainees who described overcrowded rooms, poor sanitation, inadequate food and medical care, and mistreatment by guards, including the use of pepper spray. The Department of Homeland Security has denied that there is a hunger strike or poor conditions.
Yes, but these protests have drawn broader attention to immigration detention centers and how detainees are being treated. In President Trump's 2nd term alone, around 400,000 people have been detained. And a recent Brookings Institution report estimates the toll on families is enormous, with around 145,000 U.S. born children separated from a parent who was detained. So today we're taking a closer look at detention and deportation under the Trump administration and the new DHS Secretary Mark Wayne Mullen.
With us this hour, we have Bridget Cambria, an immigration attorney based in Reading and executive director of ALDEA, the People's Justice Center. Bridget, thank you so much for being here on Studio 2.
Thank you for having me.
Let me welcome back to the program Nick Miroff, a staff writer for The Atlantic who covers immigration. Nick, it's nice to see you.
Good to be with you again.
And we'd love to hear from you, our listeners. What are your questions or opinions about immigration detention in America? Give us a call, 888-477-9499, or email us, studio2@whyy.org. If you're on YouTube or Facebook, drop a comment in the live chat.
And so we've heard a lot of facts about what's happening at Delaney Hall, Bridget, and I know you haven't necessarily been there, but I wanted to talk about what happens once someone is arrested by ICE and how they end up, what happens once they're detained in a center like this. I know you have clients in centers throughout Pennsylvania. And so can you just describe to us the process, arrest, how you end up in the center and what type of, I guess, due process you're owed if you're an immigrant who is detained?
Well, the situation of detention has changed a lot in this 2nd Trump administration. The processes for how people are detained are extremely different from, say, 2 years ago under the Biden administration. Currently, people are detained in various ways. There's compliance traps, meaning that immigrants will appear for their scheduled either court hearings or check-ins or supervision with ICE. And for checking in, they are taken into custody because immigration has changed their mind based on the priorities of the current administration. You have people who are apprehended at their homes. You have people that are apprehended while driving or while walking. Those are the kinds of things you see on TV. There are new agreements with local law enforcement agencies. Those are called 287G agreements, which permits local law enforcement to enforce immigration laws or notify immigration if they come upon someone who's undocumented. And that has led to an extreme spike in detentions. And you're correct, in Pennsylvania, which I call a detention state, has 8 different detention centers. Mm-hmm. It's home to the Mashannon Valley Detention Center, which is the largest in the region. It holds up to 1,600 people. Sometimes it teeters more than that. There's also Pike County, Cambria County, Clinton County. Here in Philadelphia, you have the Federal Detention Center, where Unfortunately, a lot of people who come to check in with ICE here down in Philadelphia will end up in this detention center.
Yeah, and so you have this situation where you get your people are getting scooped up or picked up by ICE in all these different ways. And so then what happens? You end up in one of these detention centers, and what does that look like?
Yeah, the discretion that ICE used to use. So, for example, do you have family? Do you have children? Is there a situation that we shouldn't detain you? All of that discretion sort of has ended. So the majority of people who come into contact with ICE are detained as long as there's bed space for them. Mm. So that's something that the administration is trying to do, increase bed space, because if a bed is available, they will fill it.
But how do they determine, or is it known how they determine which center they send you to? Is it going to be nearby? Could it be very far away? Do you know how that process works?
I don't. They could be detained anywhere where there's a bed. So if you are detained locally, you will be detained in a center, typically, if there is bed space available locally.
Yeah.
But there definitely are families who, unfortunately, when a loved one is apprehended, they'll be taken to very far away places, destinations like Louisiana or Texas.
Was that always the case, that you could be detained in Texas if you were apprehended here, or is that something that's new?
It's always been the case, but it wasn't sort of the routine practice. They would keep you local because that's where your attorney is or your family is. But things have changed now, and there definitely is more aggressive detention schemes by the administration.
And how different is a detention center from like a typical county jail, for example? Are there similarities, differences?
Well, they are similar. So a lot of the facilities in Pennsylvania are county jails.
Okay.
So immigrants are being held in facilities that are county jails. The Mashanon Valley Detention Center, that was a former federal prison. Delaney Hall, that's actually been here for a really long time. When I practiced in Philadelphia, I had clients that were in Delaney Hall. But the conditions are the same as you would have in a prison. But I think something that's important to understand is that the population are not citizens. So they don't enjoy the same rights to sort of complain about their detention the
same way. Explain that further. So what rights would a prisoner have who is an American citizen in a county jail versus someone who is detained who is not an American citizen?
Something that's really, really important is language. If you have a problem, you can tell someone about it. In these facilities, there's a lot of language isolation. There's no one that they can talk to. Another thing that's different is that in immigration custody, your medical treatment is controlled by ICE. So say you need to have surgery, or you want an appointment, or you need some kind of care, you want medicine, or a doctor has prescribed you medicine, ICE will determine if you actually get that medicine.
And how about contact to an attorney? What's supposed to happen and what actually happens?
So the involvement of an attorney in a detention case is probably the most important thing, because time matters, because immigration can move you from place to place. So if you are a criminal apprehended, you sort of immediately have that right. We see it on TV. You have the right to talk to an attorney. In immigration, it's when ICE allows you to make that call. So often we find that people who are detained aren't permitted to talk to an attorney until they have reached that final destination. Mm-hmm. So a lot of times we get notified, for example, at Aldea, because we have a lot of detention cases, by family members, neighbors, friends. They will call and say, so-and-so has been detained, and then we have to go find them.
You have to go find them. And before we bring Nick into the conversation, got to ask you about visitation. And are kids sort of kept here, too, if a family is detained, for example, and everybody's undocumented? How does that work?
So visitation is really limited. So you are subject to different schedules for visitation. Also, if your loved one happens to be undocumented, they won't be able to visit you in these centers. As far as families, there still is family detention in the United States. It used to be in Pennsylvania in Berks County, where we're from. There no longer is a detention center there. But there are families being detained in Texas in the Dilley Detention Center. So families can still be apprehended. But a nuance they're doing now is that when parents are apprehended or families are apprehended, a lot of times they're offering parents a Sophie's choice. And this involves both U.S. citizens and immigrant children. You can be separated from your child, or you can take your child with you. So what parent would choose to take their child to a jail? What parent would choose to take their child and have them deported to a country where it's unsafe? So they're being faced with this Sophie's choice.
And it seems like, Nick, this is part of a broader strategy. Nick Miroff, staff writer for The Atlantic, I want to bring you into the conversation. And this is out in the open, I believe, that the administration wants to encourage people to self-deport. What you're hearing Bridget describe here, is that part of an overall strategy to get people to sort of give up and leave voluntarily? Is it disconnected from that? We had heard about maybe incentives for people to do that. Just, I would like you to fit this into the sort of the overall, what the administration is trying to accomplish with everything that Bridget has laid out here.
Yeah, I mean, what Bridget has described is the U.S. immigration enforcement system as it has existed for a long time, only it's just been ratcheted up a little bit more under this administration. I mean, keep in mind that the Trump administration came in with this lofty promise of, the president saying he was going to deport millions of people, the largest mass deportation campaign in U.S. history. So he made these huge promises and then brought in a very aggressive regime, you know, led by then DHS Secretary Kristi Noem. And a big part of the Noem team's strategy was to try to scare as many people as possible into leaving. This is before they had all the money provided through the One Big Beautiful Bill that the administration got last summer. And so knowing that they didn't quite have the kind of the implements, the architecture of a mass deportation apparatus in place yet, I think they really leaned heavily into a lot of the messaging around scaring people to leave. And that ultimately ended up being one of the things that got Kristi Noem in trouble, because she cut all those ads, threatening people into trying to get them to leave. And so since then, since the One Big Beautiful Bill has passed, ICE has been able to scale up its infrastructure with more detention beds, hiring thousands of new officers and agents, acquiring all these planes. But again, some of these things are what led to Noem's demise. And now we have a new secretary in Mark Wayne Mullen, who started in late March after the disaster, the political disaster, at least for the administration of Minneapolis. And so right now, you know, we're in a kind of a post-Minneapolis phase where it's not entirely clear which direction the administration wants to go.
Yeah. And so, you know, Nick, my follow-up to you is that have you seen, are there signs of things that have shifted or have stopped now that there's this new leadership, even though the new direction hasn't necessarily been made clear yet? What have you seen shift as someone who watches this?
Yeah, well, I mean, if you think about it, the president is, you know, famously a reality TV producer. And if you think about the first episode or chapter of this administration's immigration enforcement campaign was really led by Noem and Corey Lewandowski and Greg Bovino, the Border Patrol commander, who Noem and Lewandowski sent into a series of U.S. cities, you know, run by Democrats, of course, Los Angeles, Chicago, several other cities, and then ultimately Minneapolis. And so that phase was a kind of, you know, maximum impact, intentionally kind of spectacular, both in a way to kind of encourage and scare people into leaving, but also I think as a way to really thrill the president's base and core supporters who were expecting this, you know, mass deportation campaign. Well, all of that really kind of blew up in January in Minnesota with the killing of Renee Good and Alex Preddy. You saw the administration back off, fire Greg Bovino, Kristi Noem is removed, and Tom Homan, the border czar, was brought in to kind of change tactics, lower the temperature, and regroup. And we're now at a phase in which you have Homan and Mullen, the new secretary, insisting that the mass deportation campaign is still on track and that they're going to go
and
forward.
Nick, and that's what sort of what I'm saying, what has shifted, because it still seems like there's still people being detained. It still seems like the number of arrests is just not as loud as it was maybe a few months ago, and it's not as in your face. So it seems like it's still going on. It's just not as theatrical for lack of a better word, as it was under the past leadership of DHS. Is that fair?
Yeah, I mean, yeah. This administration is not going to like tell ICE to just stand down, but it's a big, you know, big part of it is the optics and whether or not you see it. And I think what they, you know, have realized or came to realize after Minneapolis was something that, you know, veteran ICE officials like Tom Homan know, which is that the American public typically recoils when they see what domestic immigration enforcement actually looks like. It's very ugly. And it's very emotional and messy and controversial, and it looks chaotic. And so they have backed off of that, but that doesn't mean that they're backing off of their mass deportation goals. They're just going about it differently. The number of people who are in ICE custody has declined a little bit since Minneapolis. It's down about 10%. But, you know, over the coming months, they've got all these new ICE officers who are going to be hitting the streets. They have billions and billions of dollars to spend on this deportation effort through the One Big Beautiful Bill. And so I don't think there's any reason to believe that, you know, they're going to ultimately back off. If it's just a little quieter.
Yeah. We're asking for your comments and calls today. Specifically, what are your questions or opinions about immigration detention in America? Our number is 888-477-9499. Our email is studio2@whyy.org. YouTube, Facebook, comment in the live chat. Have some comments here. Diamond Girl on YouTube says, it's beyond reprehensible to think of thousands of families separated. Where are all the babies and children? Look a Bear on YouTube says, not having mold and bugs in food is not an ask. It's a right. Mark Wayne Mullen shouldn't be in charge of anything. I want to play this clip now from Jeff Van Drew, who's a representative who represents part of New Jersey, South Jersey. He was in Delaney Hall, this facility in Newark, and he claimed the conditions in there were adequate, beyond adequate. These were his comments to NJ.com. Let's roll that clip in.
These people that are in there are living better and being treated better than probably half of America and 90% of the world. They have medical care. They have physicians, nurses. They have a law library. They have a regular library. They have all the facilities. They have a beautiful soccer field. Food look great. It smell great.
Okay, so Bridget Cambria, I want to bring you back in the conversation. Most people have never been inside one of these facilities. We have no idea what it's like. Most people have probably never even been inside a standard prison in Pennsylvania either. So I want you to do your best to describe what you've seen and whether you feel like the conditions have gotten appreciably worse over the last couple of years.
Well, I think that the conditions in detention have maintained steadily bad. I don't think that it's that they've improved. I think that the detention system has always been bad.
Yeah, we're just paying attention now.
We're just paying attention now. However, there is overcrowding. There are new people who are detained that weren't detained before. So I disagree that the current administration is simply doing the same thing that other administrations have done. That's just not true. Enforcement levels are way beyond what they were before. And the types of people we're detaining are different. So in Delaney Hall, for example, only 70% of the people who are detained in Delaney Hall have no criminal record at all. These are people who have long-term presence in the United States. They have children outside. These are people we would not normally detain. And something unique about the administration that doesn't get a lot of press is that they have changed their belief on who qualifies to be released from custody and who doesn't. So a lot of the outrage you see in protests that are at Delaney are because people are being denied their lawful right to seek release from custody. It is the position of the government currently that people who have entered the United States without inspection have no right to bond, which is bail, meaning that they have no ability to ask a judge to leave. They have no ability to file. There's no amount of money that they could possibly pay to be released from custody. So what you have are people being detained unlawfully with no ability to leave. It creates desperation. You have families that are separated, and they have no idea if they're going to see, for example, their father again in a very long time. That desperation creates panic. The lawlessness that the administration is using in making sure that these beds stay filled is unprecedented.
Yeah. And my follow-up to you is this. I know that there is a backlog of millions of cases. Yeah. And I wonder, is there a timeline? Because, you know, one of the things we have, you know, speedy trial, you know, a right to speedy trial under the U.S. Constitution. You can't just keep people, you know, incarcerated indefinitely, even without bail, without giving them some type of redress. How does that work when it comes to detention? Can people just be kept in there for years when it could take forever to get a hearing?
2 months ago, I had my longest detainee ever released from custody. He was in immigration custody for 6 years. 6 years. So, yes, you can be detained indefinitely in the immigration system. What I'm talking about, people not having this right to be released, that is unique, and it has resulted in more than 10,000 habeas petitions being filed in our federal courts. So because the immigration courts...
Can I stop you for a second? Because we have a comment. Carolina from Philly wants to ask, the federal courts seem to be granting habeas petitions and ruling many of these detentions unlawful. When so much of what's going on is predicated on law enforcement, it seems contradictory that these agencies are breaking the law to fulfill their purpose. The courts have ruled they're breaking the law over and over. I'm shocked that people don't seem to care about that part. How do we make them care? Let's break this part down. Mm. These habeas petitions, what are they? Are the courts saying these people should be released and they're not being released in contradiction of the courts? What's actually happening here?
What the courts are ruling is that the legal basis, the statutory basis for the detention that the government is applying to every single person in custody is illegal. And instead of in a normal Department of Justice, in a normal, you know, as an attorney, we follow what judges tell us. But the current government, even though they've been ruled against 90% of the time about, they are still not following all of these judges' rulings. So what this...
So then what do? Do you appeal to a higher court? What happens?
No, you just have to keep filing these petitions. So there's more than 10,000 petitions currently pending. It's bogging down the federal courts, and immigrants are overwhelmingly winning. But you have to get to federal court. You have to have an attorney. It is not cheap to go to a federal court and seek your release when it is your legal right. And most courts are determining, one, it's your legal right, and two, ICE is denying you that legal right.
And I just want to, you know, for folks who are just used to the criminal justice system, and if this was a criminal case, for example, these are not criminal cases, these are different cases, but if this was a criminal case, how would things look differently as you're trying to petition? You would get an attorney, like, Tell us the differences.
So the difference in the immigration system, by the way, the immigration system is considered civil. Mm-hmm. That's why you do not get an appointed attorney. So you are not provided an attorney. An attorney is at your own expense. You do not have the right to see a judge immediately to seek bail. And according to the government now, you don't even have the right to receive bail. So all these detention centers that are being slowly filled up, and they will stay full with this position of the government. They're using these rules to snatch people off the streets, keep them without the ability to be released. But if you are a criminal charged with the worst crime, you still would have the right to see a judge and present a case to be released from custody. An immigrant that enters the country without status has no right ever to be released from custody under the position of the current government, and that is completely new.
And so you're outlining the difference between a civil defendant and a criminal defendant, mm-hmm. and that's a big, important point here.
Yep.
We're going to come back to the other side of this break. I want to bring Nick Miroff back into the conversation to talk about these plans for expansion, because mm-hmm. there are plans to expand the government's detention capacity in this country. Some of those plans run right through the state of Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
We're also getting your questions and calls about immigration detention in America. Our number is 888-477-9499. Our email is studio2@whyy.org. If you're on YouTube or Facebook, you can drop a comment in the live chat. We're talking this hour with Nick Miroff, staff writer for The Atlantic, who covers immigration, and Bridget Cambria, immigration attorney and executive director of ALDEA, the People's Justice Center. Don't go anywhere. You're listening to Studio 2.
Welcome back to Studio 2 here on WHYY. I'm Cherry Gregg.
I'm Avi Wolfman Aaron. Before we jump back into our conversation about immigration detention, we wanted to let you know about our next live event. It'll be Thursday, June 18th, we're taking the show on the road to Carpenter's Hall right here in Old City for a live broadcast about the founding of Pennsylvania.
Yes, it will be exactly 250 years to the day when a delegation met at Carpenter's Hall to declare Pennsylvania's freedom from the British and start the process of becoming a commonwealth.
We'll also talk about how the Pennsylvania Constitution came to be and how the document has endured to the present day.
Yeah, you can join us for this special live event at noon on June 18th, but you need to register at whyy.org/events.
Now let's get back to our conversation this hour about immigration detention and deportation. We have with us Bridget Cambria, immigration attorney and executive director of ALDEA, the People's Justice Center, and Nick Miroff, staff writer for The Atlantic, who covers immigration.
Yes, and we would love to hear from you, our listeners on the road or elsewhere. What are your questions or opinions about immigration detention in America? You can give us a call. The number is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on Facebook or YouTube, you can leave a comment in the chat.
Let's bring in a caller. Yeah. This is Steve from Chestnut Hill. Steve, you are on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Trump's stated policy is apprehension and deportation of illegal immigrants. And while they are snatching some of those up, most of the people that they're snatching are not necessarily illegal immigrants, and they are detaining everyone, and they're building more detention centers. So it looks to me like the system is being built to get people out of society and create a money stream for those people who run the detention centers.
Thank you. And by the way, this is not Steve from Chestnut Hill. What is your name, and where are you calling from?
I'm calling from Ohio.
Okay. Thank you so much for that call. Let me bring in now Steve from Chestnut Hill. Can we bring in Steve? We're right here on Studio 2. Hi, Steve. Sorry about that. What's your question or comment?
Actually, very similar to the immediately previous one. First and second administration with Trump, it's all about plunder. I think there's too much analysis. It's 100% about plunder and conspiracy to do so. And I would like to know when the criminals who are doing all of this will start to be treated like the criminals that they themselves are.
Yeah. All right. Well, we'll let that question go into the wind, and I'm sure someone in the political realm can answer that. But Nick Miroff, let's talk about expansion plans here. You wrote this back in March. Over the past several months, DHS has purchased 11 large warehouses around the country that it plans to convert into mega jails, some with space for up to 10,000 detainees. And I believe one of those warehouses is in Berks County, not far from Philadelphia here. It has run into some roadblocks with the state government, but nonetheless, can you give us the latest on those plans to expand the government's detention capacity?
Yeah, well, these warehouses are part of a plan that was hatched very early on in the administration to get to 100,000 beds of basically detention capacity. When the Biden administration left, ICE had about 35,000 beds in its network of detention facilities and jails. And the administration's calculus was that in order to get to a million deportations a year, as the president said as a goal, that they needed to have 100,000 beds available around the country. And so they hatched this plan to use, you know, all of these the resources provided through that One Big Beautiful Bill to to really remake the ICE detention model. And a big part of that was around building these large capacity sites that would be more evenly distributed around the country and crucially closer to the big population centers where they wanted to make more arrests, especially out west and in the Northeast, where they, as we've been discussing, have very little capacity. And so the Kristi Noem and Corey Lewandowski last fall really directed this kind of warehouse shopping spree. And they went out and they spent $1 billion to acquire these 11 properties around the country, in some cases overpaying by 50% above the market value. That whole plan has really, for the most part, been put on hold. There is there's an Office of Inspector General, like an internal investigation at DHS now underway into how those purchases were made. And so the future of that, you know, this plan of this, you know, these warehouses, and crucially their conversion from, you know, kind of e-commerce warehouses into ICE detention sites, all of that is really up in the air right now.
And I have a quick follow up for you, Nick, because there has been, you know, sort of community pushback. And so there's a two pronged question I have. First of all, there's been the Delaney Hall Detention Center, we understand, is privately run. So there's that question of who's running some of these facilities. And then the other question is the question of community pushback, because I've seen in both red and blue states, red and blue communities, people sort of shutting down zoning changes, anything, if they get a whiff of a potential detention center coming to their community. Just your thoughts on both of these as communities try to navigate potentially bringing a problem to their neighborhood, so to speak.
Yeah, there's been an extraordinary backlash to this ICE warehouse plan, including in communities where the administration expected local officials to be far more welcoming. I think a lot of it is not about concern for, you know, immigrants or conditions. It's really about, it's a kind of NIMBYism. People just don't want these kinds of facilities in their communities. And they also have seen, I think, a lot of the controversy. I think the controversy, you know, that they saw in Chicago and in Minnesota and whatnot did not help ICE's cause. And so the fact that that Kristi Noem and Corey Lewandowski and the administration kind of went in and just bought these places without doing the kind of, work on the ground to kind of build support for their plan has really kind of blown up in their face. And has left the administration in this position where it's got widespread opposition to its plans, and it needs. In all these communities where they have these warehouses, they're going to need, if they're going to convert them into detention centers, they're going to need to apply for permits for sewer alterations, for water services, for all these things that are going to rely on these local politicians to approve. And their local, the local residents in these communities are dead set against these ICE plans. And so it's a big problem for the administration.
Yeah. On that point, there were a couple purchases that I'm aware of in Pennsylvania, one in Berks County, one in Schuylkill County, that were part of this warehouse to detention center conversion scheme. And the Pennsylvania Department of Environmental Protection issued orders around the sewage and water use at those sites. And that's still hung up in appeals. I don't think it's clear yet, Bridget, how that's all going to materialize. What are you watching locally in terms of how the detention capacity situation is developing here in our region? I know, look, you're an attorney, but you must have at least one eye on how this is going and how it could affect some of your clients.
So the facilities that they're proposing in Pennsylvania, first, I just want to say they're proposing them in Pennsylvania because they can. In the states that surround Pennsylvania, there are legislative efforts to not have detention in those states. Pennsylvania allows it. It's why we have so many. And the two detention centers that they're proposing, which are warehouses, would house almost 10,000 people. Moshannon, largest in the region, 1,600. Imagine the scale of that. And taxpayers will pay for every bed, for every person, for every day that they're detained. There are two facilities, one in Berks and one in Schuylkill County in Tremont. Both communities are rejecting these facilities. Nick is correct that a detention center will have an upheaval in the community. For example, if you turn on your water and you don't get water, you might be pissed about that, to be honest. And these communities are small, and they're chosen for a purpose, that perhaps if we throw enough money at these poor rural communities, they'll allow us to have these detention centers here. But what a detention center does to a community is it scares everyone away. It becomes a ghost town. It becomes the only thing that functions in those areas will be a detention center.
Does that happen in the Moshannon Valley facility?
I believe that the Moshannon Valley facility is important for that region because it provides a lot of jobs. But that just means you don't have other jobs. And Moshannon Valley is right next to a beautiful state forest. And in the middle of that forest is a giant prison. Yeah. So it's what do you want your community to be? Berks County is rejecting the facility. Schuylkill County is rejecting the facility. There are people on the ground. There are campaigns that are being levied to make sure that these facilities
do not open. Do you believe those campaigns will be successful ultimately?
I do, because in Berks County, we were part of the group that that worked very hard for many years to end family detention in the county of Berks. And that was on the ground providing, you know, legal assistance, making sure people knew it was there. So we are familiar in our area about whether we do or do not want a detention center. Berks County, the people of Berks County, I'm a Berks County resident. I don't want a detention center in my backyard. Mm-hmm. But 10,000 people, that will destroy Berks County. That'll destroy Schuylkill County. We will have a mass exodus of people from our area. We want better economy, not less people. We want, you know, more things to come to our area, more businesses, not detention centers that scare everyone away. It will be detrimental. So the people have rejected it. And they've rejected it for humanitarian reasons, but it will affect their lives every single day if a detention center opens up in their backyard.
Yeah, let me read a couple comments. We have Monica, who says, detention is big business. Trump donors are running those facilities. It pays to keep people detained indefinitely. Mike from Germantown says, how did we get to a place where we got so many millions of immigrants that are coming to our country in the first place? Maybe the way they're handling it is not right, but shouldn't we at least acknowledge the challenges of mass migration? And so, Nick, I just kind of wanted to ask you, I mean, there was this big plan, we talked about it, from the Trump administration to do this mass deportation, one unlike we've ever seen in America. Now we're seeing the realities of that, detention of thousands and thousands of people, communities, you know, families separated, communities upended. It's expensive. Just sort of realistically, I mean, can the government realistically, with what we have now, actually complete the job that Trump started? And if so, I mean, what are the repercussions of that? Because you got people who are being detained indefinitely. You got, you know, friction caused in communities, and you know, the beat goes on and on as far as these ripple effects.
I mean, they certainly have the money to do the largest mass deportation campaign in American history. And so, you know, do they have their part? There are people around the president, certainly Stephen Miller and others, who have, we know that they have the will to do it. They got $170 billion for immigration enforcement in the One Big Beautiful Bill last summer. That is more than 17 times the annual budget of ICE. They are hiring thousands of new ICE officers and agents. They are they're putting everything in place in order to do a mass deportation campaign. Now, are they in a stage right now where they're kind of, you know, regrouping and assessing how they can do it with while minimizing the political blowback? I think so. I mean, we're in it's before the midterms. They saw the damage that was done to the president's image and the president's approval rating on immigration by the fiasco in Minneapolis. And so they're trying to chart a new path that is going to get them the kinds of numbers that they have set as a goal and is going to deliver the kind of numbers that the president has promised his supporters while trying to kind of minimize the political liabilities that doing a mass deportation campaign are going to bring.
Let me read this comment from Steve in LBI, who says, a lot of the people who are detained overstayed their visas, stayed 10 years, had kids here, even though they knew they were breaking the law. This discussion is forgetting that. Mm. Bridget, as someone who advocates for folks who are in detention and has for a long, long time, what's your response to someone like Steve and other folks in our comments who are raising that point?
Yeah, both of the comments about, you know, acknowledging the fact that there are people here undocumented and for very long times. I guess you have to ask the question about whether the answer to somebody overstaying their visa or crossing a line is cruelty at all costs. You have to ask yourself, is that the society and is that the response that we want to do? Spending exorbitant amounts of money, levying extraordinary force against people who are simply trying to survive in various different forms. So something that our immigration system has faulted in many years is there's never been a solution. It's always extremes. Either no rules or this complete level of enforcement that is extremely expensive and that we're going to put all of our resources as a government into. Common sense solutions just aren't happening. It hasn't happened in any administration that I've practiced 20 years. The laws haven't changed for immigration in more than 20 years. But we do have to ask ourselves, how do we want to respond to the neighbor or the stranger? How are we going to respond to that? Do we respond to it with force, or do we respond to it with ideas or a solution? And right now, the only thing that we have is force.
Mm. Well, that's Bridget Cambria. I want to thank you so much for your time today. Bridget's an immigration attorney and executive director of ALDEA, the People's Justice Center. Bridget made a long trek today to be here in the studio, so thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
And same to you, Nick Miroff, staff writer for The Atlantic, who covers immigration. Always great to have you on the program, Nick.
Thanks. Good to be with you.
Yeah, thank you to everybody who called in. Carlos, we lost your call. We're sorry we didn't get to bring you on air. But, of course, we got to thank as well our producers, Debbie Bilder, Hazel May Bryan, and Paige Murray Bessler. Mike Schiffler is our visual producer. Al Banks and Tina Calicay engineered today's show. Our executive producer is Kevin McCory. From Studio 2 here at WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gregg.
I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. We'll talk to you tomorrow.